You ever watch a jet pull out of a dive at an air show and feel that pressure in your chest? That moment where the crowd goes quiet and then erupts? There's a reason those jets do not fly straight at you anymore. There's a reason for the crowd line, the show line, the hard deck. And the reason has a name. His name was John Derry. I'm Tail Dragger on the Hangar, here on Radio Hangar. And today we are going back to an afternoon in England that changed every air show you have ever attended. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you have earned it, they have got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, September 6, 1952. Farnborough, Hampshire, England. The Society of British Aircraft Constructors Air Show. This was not some county fair with a biplane doing lazy eights. Farnborough was the showcase. Every major British manufacturer brought their newest, fastest, most ambitious machines, and they flew them hard in front of 120,000 people. Pilots, engineers, politicians, families with children sitting on blankets on the grass. The Cold War was on. The jet age was barely 5 years old, and Britain was desperate to prove it could build fighters to match anything coming out of the Soviet Union or out of America. So the flying was aggressive. The crowds were close, and nobody thought twice about it. John Derry was 30 years old, square jaw, calm eyes, the kind of pilot other pilots watched. 2 years earlier, on September 9, 1948, he had become the first British pilot to exceed the speed of sound. He did it in a de Havilland 108 Swallow, a beautiful little swept-wing research jet diving from high altitude and punching through Mach 1 in a controlled transonic run. The Americans had Chuck Yeager, the British had John Derry, and unlike Yeager's flight in the Bell X-1, which was a rocket-powered bullet designed for nothing else, Derry did it in a machine that was closer to a production airplane that took nerve of a different kind. By 1952, Derry was the chief test pilot for de Havilland, and the airplane he was demonstrating at Farnborough that day was the DH-110. Twin boom, twin engine, a big swept-wing fighter designed for the Royal Navy. Two Rolls-Royce Avon turbojets. It was fast, it was loud, and Derry knew how to make it sing for a crowd. His observer in the back seat was Anthony Richards, a young flight test observer. Good man. Quiet. Professional. Now here is where it gets interesting, and where it gets terrible. Derry's routine called for a high-speed pass along the runway, then a pull-up into a steep climbing turn. He had done it before. He had done it the previous day at the same show. But on this pass, he was moving. Estimates put him right around the speed of sound, maybe just past it, low over the airfield. The crowd heard the double crack of a sonic boom rolling across the grass. People flinched, some cheered. That was the whole point. Then he pulled back on the stick. The airplane was carrying tremendous energy, and somewhere in that pull-up, at high transonic speed and high G loading, the outer section of the right wing failed, just separated. And when one wing goes on a twin-boom airframe, the whole structure comes apart in a heartbeat. The DH-110 broke up in the air. The engines, still producing thrust, tore free of the disintegrating fuselage. And this is the part that haunts Farnborough to this day. One of those engines, a Rolls-Royce Avon still spinning at full power, came down into the crowd. The other engine went into the spectator area on the other side. Wreckage scattered across the hillside where families were sitting. John Derry and Tony Richards were killed instantly, but they were not alone. 29 spectators died that afternoon. 29 people who came to watch airplanes. 63 more were injured, many of them seriously. The hill where the engines hit was packed. There was no barrier, no setback, nothing between the flying and the watching. That was just how it was done. Pull up a chair for this next part, because what happened after the crash tells you everything about 1950s aviation culture. They did not stop the show.
The announcer, Neville Duke, himself a legendary test pilot, came on the public address system and acknowledged the accident. Emergency crews rushed to the hillside, and then the next act taxied out and took off. The show continued for the rest of the afternoon. The crowd stayed. Some of them had just watched people die a few hundred yards away, and they stayed to watch the next airplane fly. Today, that sounds insane. In 1952, it was considered stoic, proper British. The show must go on, stiff upper lip, but behind the scenes, something was shifting. The investigation that followed found that the DH-110 had experienced aerodynamic separation of the wing leading edge at transonic speed under G-loading. The structure simply was not designed for the combination of forces Derry had asked it to absorb. De Havilland redesigned the wing. The airplane eventually entered Royal Navy service years later as the Sea Vixen, and it served well. But the structural failure was only half the lesson. The real lesson was about the geometry between the airplane and the crowd. Before Farnborough 1952, air show flying was essentially unrestricted. Pilots flew over the crowd, toward the crowd, past the crowd, at whatever speed and altitude they chose. The spectators were wherever they wanted to be. There were no show lines, no crowd lines, no minimum distances. The entire concept of energy management relative to spectator placement simply did not exist as a formal discipline. After those 29 people died, that changed. Not overnight. It took years for formal regulations to crystallize, but the Farnborough disaster planted the seed for every airshow safety rule you see today. The show line, the crowd line, the separation between them, the hard deck, the rule that aerobatic maneuvers must be flown parallel to the crowd, not toward it. The idea that if an engine separates or a wing folds, the wreckage trajectory should carry it away from people, not into them. In Britain, the Civil Aviation Authority eventually codified display flying regulations that became the model for the rest of the world. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, developed its own airshow waiver system under Part 91, establishing minimum distances, altitude floors, and energy management requirements. The International Council of Airshows built an entire safety culture around these principles.
And every one of those rules traces back, in one way or another, to a hillside in Hampshire. I think about John Derry sometimes when I'm standing at an air show and a jet comes screaming past on the show line. I can feel the heat off the exhaust, feel my shirt press against my chest from the wake, and I think about how that jet is flying a precise line, calculated to keep its energy pointed away from me and 100,000 other people. That line exists because of what happened when it did not. Derry was not reckless. He was a superb pilot, one of the best test pilots Britain ever produced, flying a routine he had flown before in an airplane that was supposed to hold together. The airplane failed him, and the absence of any safety geometry between the airplane and the crowd turned a structural failure into a mass casualty event. There is something worth remembering there for anyone who flies at airshows today, or anyone who watches. The rules feel restrictive sometimes. Pilots grumble about the waiver requirements, the altitude floors, the mandatory standoff distances, but every one of those rules is written in somebody's name, even if we have forgotten whose. At Farnborough, 29 names. The DH-110 crash was not the only fatal airshow accident in history, not by a long shot. But it was the one that cracked the old thinking wide open. It proved that speed and spectacle and an unprotected crowd is a combination that will eventually, inevitably, produce a disaster, and it forced the aviation world to admit that the show must not just go on, it must go on safely. Most of the detail in today's story comes from Bill Gunston's work on de Havilland aircraft and the official accident investigation records held by the Royal Aerospace Establishment Archives at Farnborough. If you want to dig deeper, there's excellent material in the Derry family papers at the Royal Air Force Museum. You can find more episodes and all our past segments at radiohangar.com. Fly safe out there. And next time you're at a show and you see that crowd line painted on the taxiway, tip your hat to the people who taught us where to draw it.